Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. My guest on today's morning show is a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College, Mark Miller, who is Associate Professor of Management and Marketing. So Professor Miller would be a very close colleague of Dr. Art Sear, who is a, of course, frequent guest on the morning show, joins us actually once a month to offer up his analysis of current events and issues. It was actually Professor Sear who first mentioned the fact that Professor Miller had recently written and released a book in which he looks back more than four decades to his experiences as a soldier in Vietnam, a book called My Confessions from Vietnam, a book which he actually, I should say, co-authored or co-wrote with his own daughter, Brooke Miller Hall. And so we have Professor Miller here on the program today to talk about his experiences in Vietnam and also what it was like to relive some of those experiences over this long span of time. We should mention right off the bat, before we perhaps forget, that among a couple of different events that are coming up to help highlight interest in the book, is a presentation at Racine's Public Library, which is going to be happening on the 10th of November at 6:30 in the evening. And we'll tell you about a couple of other events that are going to be happening as well. Professor Mark Miller, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hey, Greg, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Glad you can be here. Before we talk about the book and talk about the heart and soul of your experiences in Vietnam, it would probably be interesting for people to find out a little bit about your own background and a little bit, I think, about what you do at Carthage and what's really an interesting field that most of us know very, very little about. Let's start first with just kind of a brief biographical sketch of where you're from originally and kind of the general parameters of what took you from there to where you are now.
Well, I'm a Racine native. I went to high school in St. Catharines High School in Racine. Went to college in St. Paul at St. Thomas University. After I got out of the Army, I went to work at CASE, which is now CASE CNH. And was with CASE CNH for 31 years in purchasing, inventory management, supply chain management. And when I was at CASE, I started writing business articles and speaking at conferences on purchasing, negotiation, forecasting, inventory management. And I thought the teaching might be a good second career. So I started the adjunct teaching at night while I was at CASE. And then the opportunity came up to leave CASE and start at Carthage, which I took, and I've been there for 12 years now.
Very good. Well, Carthage is glad to have you. And, of course, in your particular field especially, it's great to have somebody who was in the trenches for such a long time. I mean, you bring a wealth of real-world, real-life experience to what you teach to your students. When it comes to the sort of academic discipline of management and marketing, what are some of the most important principles that you explore in the classroom?
Well, number one, I always teach a senior thesis class, which is the capstone class at Carthage, as you're aware that all seniors have to take. And so it gives me a chance to help students produce a professional type thesis. And so working with students on writing skills is something I'm very interested in, and it's been really fun doing. And the other management courses I teach is HR management, which is talking about how companies can deal with people in the organization and have world-class employees and keep them happy and productive. And so you look at a broad range of areas such as EEO laws, discrimination laws, how you interview and select people, how you pay people, discipline people. And so that is a very interesting course to me also. And the third course I teach is operations management, which is closest to what I did at Case, where you talk about inventory management, quality, forecasting, purchasing, and supply chain management.
I suppose that for just about any kind of company, that's some of the stiffest challenges that confront a company is something, I mean, questions on the most basic level of how many of these things should we make and how many of them are needed. And once we make them, where do we put them? I mean, how do we distribute them, and what price do we attach to them? And it sounds like you were involved in just about all of those really sticky questions.
Right. It's if you think of it as like a weather forecaster, they have some information about what the weather is on the West Coast and blowing in, and they do a forecast based on what they see might happen in 2 or 3 days. But things change often, and some of the assumptions you make about what's going to happen in the weather doesn't materialize. And the other interesting thing is the farther you try to go out, if you look at what the forecast is going to be a month from now versus tomorrow, there's a lot more error rate. It's a lot more dicey when you try to figure out what's going to happen in the future. And if you have suppliers that need 90 days, 3 months, 4 months lead time to produce things, you're forecasting out pretty far. So that makes it challenging.
Yeah. Speaking of challenges, how different is this world? I mean, the world in which you and your students are hoping to operate, when it comes to matters like management, how different is the world now from, for instance, the 3 decades plus that you spent at a Case, eventually CNH? And how challenging is it for you as an educator to be responsive to whatever ways in which some of this has changed because of the advent of certain technologies and so on?
Yeah, it really has changed, Greg, if you think about it. When I first started at Case, all purchase orders were typed up manually, and you had white out on the typewriters and things like that. And computers, we did have computers, but you had punch cards. And you had to write things, and people used to actually punch the punch cards and then send them to somebody else and update them. And it was a whole different world. Calculators were, you know, the size of this whole desk and made a lot of noise, and you had tapes that came out of them and things like that. And you had secretaries and clerical people typing a bunch of things, and you don't have – everybody does – their own thing kind of now, and it's much easier and much more effective.
Interesting. But I suppose it also means in some respects people need to know more because people are doing more, because in a sense it's easier to do more, but you have to know how to do it.
Yeah, when I first started at Carthage, I taught a course in statistics. And the only statistics courses I had were in college, and back then you did everything by formulas and manually. And now statistics, a lot of statistics are done using Excel formulas, and so I had to relearn the whole field basically.
Wow. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Mark Miller, who is Associate Professor of Management and Marketing at Carthage College. But the primary reason that he is here, although it's been fun to talk about some of these other matters, but we're here primarily to talk about a book which he recently co-wrote with his daughter, Brooke Miller Hall, a book called My Confessions from Vietnam, which look back at his experiences back in Vietnam in and around the year 1970. I'm trying to decide where to begin here, because one of the things I want to talk about is the fact that you have not really talked about or written about any of these experiences for such a long time, and only now are kind of returning to these events and then, in a sense, sharing them with the world. Before we talk about what you experienced in Vietnam, I want to talk about the years after. When you came back from Vietnam, was it in 1970 or 71?
Right, 70, yes.
Okay. You came back from Vietnam, and it sounds like, for the most part, you emphatically kind of shut the door behind you and went on with your life. And you say in the book that you, over these years, have done almost nothing when it comes to, for instance, kind of associating with other military veterans and so on. So how much were you even talking about Vietnam when you returned home, talking about it, writing about it? Was it just something you completely suppressed?
Yeah, I didn't. Frankly, I was ashamed of how I performed, what kind of soldier I was in Vietnam.
Hmm.
And you got to remember what the environment was like at that time. Mm. Kent State was going on. There was protests against the Vietnam War. People were saying any soldiers coming back were baby killers. Mm. And so as far as I was concerned, I was in the Army, drafted in the Army to serve my time. And once I was done, I was done. I succeeded, and I wanted to move on with my life, and I didn't want to talk about, think about, or be involved with the military again.
Hmm. So, for instance, a lot of the people in your life, would they have even known that you were a soldier? I mean, did you, in a sense, keep it that much of a secret that most people in, I mean, obviously your family knew and certain really close friends knew, but otherwise, to a casual acquaintance, would they have even known you'd gone to Vietnam?
No, except my immediate family. Mm-hmm. Nobody knew about my history in the military at all.
Wow. So what prompted you to revisit these events?
I think the first trigger was several years ago. I was speaking at a conference in Washington, D.C., and my wife was with me, and she prompted me to go to the wall, the Vietnam War Memorial.
Hmm.
And I lost track of all the people that were in my squad in Vietnam, and I always wondered what happened to them, and if all of them made it back safely.
And are we talking about the guys that became known as the garbage squad?
Yes, exactly. The people that were in my squad, whether they made it back safely. And I found when I, and it was a very emotional experience for me, and I think a lot of that triggering, that emotion, caused me to start revisiting and digging out my long lost journal and revisiting what I had done, what had happened in Vietnam.
Mm. We should maybe mention the role that your then girlfriend played in terms of the safekeeping of this journal. Explain what she has to do with this.
Yes, her name is Debbie, and I sent home letters that were basically my journal to her. And at that time, as we discussed before, everything that was typed was done on a manual typewriter with whiteout and things. So she kept all my letters and typed them out and gave them to me when I returned, which became the basis of the journal.
Mm. So you had had this all these years,
yes.
But it was just stuck away in a box or something?
Yes, it's stuck in the bottom of a file cabinet somewhere.
Wow. So talk a moment about, first of all, the experience of rereading these journals. I mean, did they bring to mind things you had forgotten, or were your memories of Vietnam so vivid that, in a sense, none of it was forgotten, including the things you wanted to forget?
No, it brought back a lot of memories that I hadn't thought about in a long time, and they were not, some of the memories were not vivid at all.
Hmm.
So things like, well, I wonder what that person's name was and where they were from and what happened when we went on this mission were all pretty cloudy to me. And again, you got to remember that was 40 years ago.
Right, absolutely. Oh, yeah. I mean, when I try to think, of course, I was 10 in 1970, but I mean, I couldn't possibly piece together, of course, on the other end, I didn't experience anything as memorable as did you. But yes, that's a long time to be looking back across and to trying to recall exactly what you experienced and what it felt like in the moment. Tell us about the role that your daughter Brooke plays in all of this.
Well, my daughter is a journalist, a writer. She's anything I write, she is my editor.
Hmm.
And so she really prompted me once I started talking about doing something with my journal that she volunteered to help. And so I think the summer before last, I roughed out some chapters from the journal and sent it to them. And she edited, made suggestions on how continuity, how the book could follow better, developing characters, and just to make it read much better.
Hmm.
And she was the driving force behind actually something happening with my journal.
Wow. How hard was it to do this? I mean, the writing process and the remembering process.
Remembering was a lot harder than writing for me anyways.
Huh.
Brooke would say, tell me about what this lieutenant's name was that you mentioned. You got a new lieutenant. What was his name? And I said, Brooke, I don't have a clue.
Right. And I suppose it's enough time has passed, it would be tricky to even try to discover it. I mean, if you sent away to some veteran's office or something, some of that still might not be retrievable information after all these years.
It was interesting. There's one event, a series event that happened when I was with the first CAV where we were caught in a forest fire, a firefight, and then we were attacked by giant wasps, and a lot of people were medevaced out. And I thought that was all a very interesting story. So a couple of years ago, I wrote that down and sent it to the first CAV, who has an organization that captures those kind of things, apparently. And they said, oh, yeah, three or four other of our members have written about that event already. Hmm. So that was about the only thing I've done to try to confirm how accurate my memories were.
Right. Over what period of time did it take you to write this book?
Between when I started again, the summer before last, so a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. And emotionally, what kind of experience did this end up being? I mean, did it end up being largely cathartic and maybe kind of therapeutic, or was it a more kind of wrenching experience? And did you, by the end of it, feel depleted? I mean, emotionally, what kind of a gauntlet was this, this whole process of revisiting the war and writing about it?
I think it certainly did bring back memories, especially there's a couple sections where we had a night ambush, and we went out the next morning and found a woman and a small child that were killed and things like that, which I had really blocked out and forgotten about. And those were very difficult to revisit. And when I went to the Vietnam War, I did find that one of my squad members, a member of the garbage squad, was killed in Cambodia a few months later. Mm. And that was very, very difficult.
To see his name, yes, and to think about that. We're speaking with Professor Mark Miller from Carthage College. We're talking about a book that he put together with his daughter, Brooke Miller Hall, a book called My Confessions from Vietnam, in which he looks back on his experiences in roughly 1970, when the year that he spent 1 year in Vietnam, events which he had largely blocked out and not really thought all that much about over the years. Although you mention that particularly in those early years after coming back from Vietnam, there were ways in which you were haunted, and what we sometimes hear about with soldiers, where certain sounds would be triggers for you and so on.
Yeah, especially when a car would backfire or noises, I would automatically hit the ground and as a reaction, because that's what you did over in Vietnam. And so I was very jumpy for the first couple years I got back.
Hmm. Let's talk about the circumstances under which you went to Vietnam. And right off the bat in the book, you say that you were somebody who had absolutely no aspirations whatsoever to be a soldier and to serve your country in this respect. You were a really good basketball player and probably cared about other things too, but serving in the military was not one of them. Did you have an actually kind of antagonistic idea of the military and what it would be like to serve, or was that just something just of no interest to you?
It was no interest to me. I really didn't know much about the military or what I was getting into. My father was a navigator in World War II, so I had heard his stories about World War II and the war. But there wasn't very many options. In 1968, 69, there was a draft. But it wasn't the lottery draft, which came later. This draft was controlled by the local draft board. And based on whether you had an exemption or not and what your physical condition was, you were either drafted or not drafted. And so when I was drafted right after college, some of my friends ran away to Canada.
And you say you thought briefly about doing the same thing.
Yes, I did.
Was that about escaping service, or was it based more on kind of a intellectual or moral objection to what we were doing in Vietnam? Or did you not even know that much about the conflict and the nature of why we were there?
I don't think at that time I knew that much about the nature of it. I just knew that the military didn't seem to be a career I was interested in. And again, you were drafted. I wasn't signed up, so it wasn't like you were picking a career. Your career was basically picking you. And that was also the generation where Elvis Presley went to jail, as you recall, to avoid going in the service, I believe, or did he serve? Cassius Clay.
Oh, yeah, okay, yes,
I knew
right.
Elvis
yeah.
was in the service.
Right, right, yeah, yeah. Muhammad Ali yep. was, I guess we would, I don't remember if he was a conscientious objector or just
yes.
what, but you ultimately decided that you were not going to flee to Canada, you
right.
were going to put in your time and be done with it. One of the things you say was that it was pretty wrenching to go from being, you know, a basketball star on your college campus to being essentially pretty much a nobody in that whole training process. Tell us more about that and what that felt like.
Yeah, that was quite a transition. In the Army, the philosophy in the Army is you follow orders without questioning, and you just do what you're told. Your job is to follow instructions, as I've said, and that was much different than anything I had run into before. After I was in the military for a while, and So I went to basic training and advanced infantry training. So here was somebody with a management degree, a college degree, and I was drafted and assigned to be in the infantry, which I thought was pretty ironic to start with. And but the basic training and infantry training, because I was in very good shape, the physical part was not difficult for me at all. It was more the psychological issue and following orders that were the most difficult.
At the end of that advanced infantry training, you are brought into your first sergeant's office, and a question is posed to you. And this question is a really important question because it was, in a sense, a fork in the road, and you had an important choice to make. Explain what that choice was all about.
Yeah, the first sergeant said that he saw that I was a college graduate, and he had an opportunity, a choice for me. Either I could go on leave for a couple of weeks and then be sent over to Vietnam as a private, or I could go to NCO school at Fort Benning, Georgia, and after 12 weeks be commissioned as a sergeant, basically a squad leader. And then after NCO school, you'd have another 12 weeks in the States going to an AIT unit as a drill sergeant, and then be sent over to Vietnam. So it was like a half a year of training or a half a year more in the United States before being assigned to Vietnam. And at that time, there was peace talks going on. There was protests going on. So I chose the NCO route just as a way to avoid being hoping that I wouldn't have to go to Vietnam and after 6 months.
Mm. So that was the choice you made then.
Yes.
You wanted to be done just as quickly as you possibly could. You say at the start of chapter two that during this long flight, 25-hour flight to Vietnam, you sat next to two guys who were going back for their second tour in Vietnam. And one of the things they talked to you was how useless shake-and-bake officers were. And this is something that you eventually experienced for yourself. First of all, explain to our listeners who maybe, like me, don't know what that term means, what shake-and-bake officers were.
Well, it's non-commissioned officers are not officers, so officers always got upset when you... But if you were a instant NCO, if you went to this NCO school in Fort Benning, Georgia, and in 12 weeks were turned into a sergeant, became a sergeant, you had only been in the Army something like 6 months. And this really caused irritation among people that had been in the Army a long time and had just earned the rank of sergeant.
The hard way.
So the nickname of instant NCO or shake and bake NCO became very popular. So there was a distinction between a regular sergeant and a shake and bake sergeant. And
right.
I was definitely a shake and bake sergeant.
Right. Well, and it points to something that I remember being talked about when a few years ago I interviewed someone who at the time was a teacher here at Gateway who wrote a somewhat similar memoir to yours about his experience in Vietnam. And he talks actually at great length about probably for him the single greatest source of disappointment and disillusionment was the poor quality of some of the leadership there, and how disillusioning it was for a young soldier who might, you know, if all you know about the military is what you've seen in World War II movies, you might really have a very idealistic idea of what kind of man is going to be leading you. And what you're describing is also the specter of people being thrust into leadership positions that they really weren't ready for, not properly seasoned to really be able to do with distinction.
Yeah, the biggest problem I had in NCO school, and it was run by, or at least the physical part of it, was run by the Army's elite airborne rangers, was the concept of management. And the management philosophy in the Army, as I talked about before, was you have orders and you follow the orders without questioning. And my management style has always been cooperative, getting people together. What do you think? What's the best way to do this? Trying to get consensus. And that was completely opposite from the Army way of management. Mm. And it probably had to be that way. You couldn't have people in a battle situation questioning and huddling to see what is the best course of action. But that was completely anti to how I felt things should be done.
Right.
And I think you can get a sense from the book when I talk about how the garbage squad operated in Vietnam, that it was more a cooperative thing than just me giving orders.
Right. Explain that term, too. That's an interesting story.
Well, it seems like I've always had nicknames. In high school, when I was a sophomore, they misprinted my name in the St. Catherine's yearbook. Instead of Mark, it was Mary. So for a whole year, my nickname was Mary, which was deep scars is still left.
I'm
on that
sure,
one.
Right.
I was in high school for a while. I was Mark the Spark, Sparky. When I got to college, my nickname became the Garbage Man, and it relates to how I played basketball. Well, some people conjecture that it was because of my eating habits that I would eat anything, but I think it really had to do with basketball. So when I went to Vietnam, the nickname kind of stuck, and we became the Garbage Squad. And for a while, we even had a pet monkey, which was Garbage Junior.
Wow. There are all kinds of interesting stories along the way, but one of the things I really appreciate is, because it's the kind of thing that a lot of us looking at a distance wouldn't stop to think about, was you talk about what it felt like to land in Vietnam and to just get off the plane and suddenly be in the climate of Vietnam with the incredible heat and humidity. Mm-hmm. Just how terrible was that? And was that something you ever got used to?
That's a good question. And again, you're talking about a long time ago, but it certainly was oppressive initially. And I think you somewhat got used to it. But in Vietnam, especially when we were in the highlands, it was a jungle-type atmosphere. And so half the year was very, very rainy, the rainy season. And half the year it was very warm and hot and humid. And so for 6 months when we were in the jungle, sleeping outside on the ground, it was pouring rain all the time we were out. And the other part of the year, it was oppressively hot and humid. But I think like anything else, and I think this is one of the lessons I learned in Vietnam, you can get used to anything.
Mm. The thing that is kind of hard to imagine is how hard it would be to do your work as soldiers under those kind of conditions. You know, how hard was it to remain alert, to remain awake for that matter, and to just kind of maintain a certain level of energy and attentiveness needed to keep yourself alive?
And that was a very difficult part of that I found of being in the Army, because the old adage, hurry up and wait, is very true in the Army. So a lot of what we did in the Army was waiting, sitting around on guard duty, where you just were trying to be alert and stay awake in the middle of the night. But there wasn't a lot of action. I think if you were out humping in the boonies, doing a mission out in the jungle, and thrashing through the jungle, it was much easier to keep your energy level up. But it was the sitting around part, the guard duty at night part, where you got into issues of energy and alertness.
Hmm. Tell our listeners about this this guy by the nickname of Shaky. I think that's a nickname. Yeah. I don't think that was his real name.
No, it wasn't.
This is and certainly not one of your favorite people in Vietnam.
Yeah, he was a shake and bake NCO just like I was, but in NCO school, the top people in each class were promoted to an E6, which was like a high-level sergeant, a platoon sergeant rather than a squad leader.
Mm.
And so his mission was, he was one of those soldiers that was gung-ho, the military was going to be his career, and he wanted to get ahead. Where the rest of us were of the philosophy, how could we survive this for a year and stay safe? Our job, we weren't looking to kill communists and keep the Red Menace away from our door. Our job was to survive this for a year and get back home safe. And it was two different philosophies. Certainly, Shaky was what I call a lifer, one of those that wanted to get ahead and wanted to make a name for themselves. And there was a lot of officers that we had that were also of this mindset.
Right.
So there was a conflict there.
Of terrible, of course. What's interesting to me, too, is I wonder, I mean, like you said it, and you say it in the book almost exactly that way, that you had no interest in killing anyone or in being killed. I mean, and for you, that was the most important thing, was to not get killed and, if possible, not kill anybody.
Right.
And then you have somebody like this Shaky person who was there and had very different goals. But even somebody like that, what was your sense of to what extent he was invested in the mission of defeating the Red Menace, or for somebody like that, was it really a much more kind of selfish enterprise? Is that what was driving him?
I think it was much more selfish, and this was probably one of the first real guerrilla wars that happened, and I think you learned in Vietnam that you didn't know who the enemy was, who your friends were. So to say you're going to defeat the enemy was a very difficult thing.
Hmm.
If somebody started shooting at you, you had a pretty good idea they were not a friend. But besides that, it was a very difficult thing. So how do you... Who is the enemy, and how do you even defeat him? So I would say he was more interested in really getting ahead and being selfish.
Right. And there's an interesting moment in the book at one point where you come across a village, and the village is essentially deserted, and the only sign of life there are some of the pigs that are running around. Explain to our listeners what happens then.
Well, and then we called in and asked what to do, and the instructions were this might be a staging area for the Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese, and the pigs could be used for their food, so burn the village and kill the pigs. And so that's what we did. But the interesting part of that I found was when we reported that what we had done back to Shaky, his response was, count up how many dead pigs there was, because we're going to count those as head count and enemy soldiers being killed. And so you hear, back in Vietnam, every day on the news, they reported how many casualties they were among U.S. troops and how many enemy casualties they were in the, the enemy numbers were always very high compared to the U.S. numbers, but it gets you wondering how accurate the enemy numbers really were.
Right. It became very quickly so much more about giving the illusion of progress and progress towards victory, and so much of that, unfortunately, was illusory. And, of course, in the meantime, you have young soldiers who are put in peril, and with this sort of veil of deceit kind of hanging over at least some of the enterprise. There are at least a couple moments in the book when you disregard orders. And it must be interesting for you to look back on that. When you look back on those instances, and this is not where you're face-to-face disregarding an order, it's you're disregarding an order and pretty sure that no one will even ever know. But when you look back on that, those moments where you're not following orders, do you look back on those moments with pride, or are you ashamed of those moments, or some strange mix of the two? How do you view those incidents?
Well, it's probably a strange mix of the two, and that's why the title My Confessions from Vietnam actually came from, because we did a lot of things to hide, to avoid trouble, where we didn't follow orders at all. And there were some other things in the book, things like I stopped taking my malaria pills because I thought getting malaria would be, and being in a hospital in the rear area would be safer than being out in the field.
It would just be a break.
And
this was something you heard about other guys doing.
Yeah. And then the other main issue, one of my friends from college was an accountant, a clerk, working in Vietnam, and he found out I was in Vietnam, so he forged orders for me to get me reassigned to a safe rear area job. And so I think part of the reason why I never wanted to talk about Vietnam is I never felt like I had done a good job as a soldier. As a soldier, my main goal was to get home safely and get my squad home safely. It wasn't to fulfill the typical roles of a soldier.
Right. I suspect that to whatever extent that's true, and I'm sure to some extent it is true. I mean, you lived the life you know, and you're being honest with yourself and about yourself. How much do you think that had to do with the men who were above you and the way in which you were led? Do you think that contributed to, in a sense, the kind of soldier that you were there?
Sure, but I think it also gets back to having a draft and having 25% of your force were being forced to be there. And 75% had volunteered, and that's going to cause conflicts right away. And I think the all-volunteer army, which we have now, is certainly resolves that conflict, or at least some of the conflict.
Right. You've mentioned that one of your most painful memories of Vietnam is an incident in which you thought your squad was maybe repelling an attack or picking off snipers or whatever with, I forget if it was a grenade or something that was thrown, but ultimately when you went to look, what was found was a woman and her baby. I'm just curious, when you probably never in a million years imagined that you would ever be part of something like that. What was it like to think about that and write about that and revisit that really painful moment?
Yeah, that was probably one of the worst things about reopening my journal, because that was very difficult. And what it was, we were out on a night ambush where we were set up next to a trail that the Viet Cong were known to travel on at night. And it was pitch dark. Jungle noises, and you start hearing sounds coming down the trail. And you had mines and grenades and things like that set up along the trail. And you had to make the decision whether you're going to blow the ambush, blow up the mines or not. And we did. The next morning when we went back to look, we found that it didn't turn out the way we imagined.
Right. Yeah, and it was not would-be snipers that...
Right, but nobody should have been on that trail in the middle of the night either.
Right, right. One of the things that's interesting now is that not only have you written this book, but now you're beginning to talk about this. What is that like to be, first of all, fielding questions about your experiences there? Because in some ways you control the narrative when you have written a book, but when you begin to open yourself up to the questions that get posed to you, it's a whole different kind of thing. What does that feel like?
It is very different, and this is, as we talked earlier, the first experience I've had actually talking about it, although I am going to have some other opportunities to do that. And it's interesting, I guess, since I'm used to the classroom and telling stories about my background in business, that it isn't too foreign. But obviously there are some things that memories that cause me some pain.
Yeah, I bet. I know one of the talks that you have coming up is something in which you're going to be discussing management ideas or principles learned from Vietnam.
Right.
And we don't have a lot of time, just a minute and a half or so. But I'm just curious. I mean, I want to meld it with another question, which is, you know, if you could wave a magic wand and change the way men were led in Vietnam, I mean, or change the way management occurred in Vietnam, what would have made it better? I imagine that's part of the lessons learned from Vietnam.
Well, not really, but the all-volunteer army versus a draft, I think, is a big thing. It's very hard to manage people that don't want to be there, even in the business world.
Right.
But my lessons, and I think the last part of the chapter I go into depth about this, is number one, network as much as you can. You can't have too many friends. The way you find a job is through networking. And the way my fellow accountant from St. Thomas saved my life because he changed some orders for me.
Right.
And it made me appreciate also the military. It's really a tough, thankless job. And I really appreciate and thank anybody who serves, especially voluntarily now in the service. I really appreciate what a tough job and a thankless job it is.
You've been there. Yep. You've been there. And thankfully, we seem to live in an era now where our veterans do not meet the kind of hostility and suspicion that, for instance, you potentially did back in 1970. Well, the book again is called My Confessions from Vietnam, and you're going to have a book signing and conversation about it at the Racine Public Library on the 10th of November at 6:30 in the evening, and you have a couple of other events coming up, including one at Carthage, where I think some excerpts from this are going to be read. But
yeah, that's right. I think that's on November 16th. That the theater group is doing in commemoration of Veterans Day, is doing an event. And the day after that, I'm doing something in Racine at the APEX professional development meeting, talking about management lessons that I found from my days in Vietnam.
Professor Mark Miller, I'm so glad you could join us today for this this